Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening, Eastern family and friends. Welcome to the EAL Radio Show. Wow! Do we have a great show for you tonight? And for you guests, watch us. So sit back and enjoy the show for you tonight. And listen to the 252nd radio broadcast. You know, we're in our sixth year every Monday evening now. We're coming to you live from many different locations. That's what's so amazing with cyber broadcasting. Our hosts and listeners are in many locations, but come together as one every Monday at this time. We're glad you're listening, and we hope you'll join in on our discussions. Neil has mentioned that our little radio show is kitchen table radio. Perhaps it does sound a little homespun with the lack of all the sophisticated radio equipment the big guys have, but it seems to be working all these years. I think the biggest reason is the subject we cover, Eastern Airlines. The real reason it is this popular. Eastern has always been an airline of first, and the radio show is carrying on that tradition, as we're sure the new Eastern will continue to do so. With each show that goes into our radio broadcast archives, it tells us, your host, that Eastern people enjoy talking and hearing about the old and the new, as we like to think of our beloved Eastern Airlines. We hope you'll participate and board our airplane, a beautiful Boeing 737-800, smartly painted in the familiar paint and livery of the old Eastern. Every Monday at this time, please be a part of our show. For those listening to the broadcast on their computers, all you need to do is to call us at 213-816-1611, and it will put you on Neil's producer's board. He can open your mic or your telephone, and you can tell us what's on your mind, or you might want to add to the subject being discussed at that time. Remember, unless Neil has opened your phone connection to join the live conversation, you'll need to press the number 1 on your phone's keypad to join in with us. Those who cannot listen in on a computer can still hear and participate by just calling the number you just heard, 213-816-1611. Also, keep in mind that your telephone or microphone picks up any noises that might be in the background, so please be sure that you mute your phone or keep as quiet as possible during the broadcast. Now, let's join flight number 252 as it moves closer to its destination, Miami International Airport. The flight departed New York's LaGuardia Airport with 146 passengers on board the Boeing 737-800 aircraft. The flight attendants have finished the lunch service and have time to join in conversation in the galley area of the airplane.
Yeah.
Another great trip and very happy people, it seems. Any problems with service?
I had one guy back in row 13 that seemed a little anxious and kept asking me in Spanish when we were going to arrive in Miami. Since I do speak Spanish, I answered in his native language. He kept looking at his watch as if he needed to do something, although there's not much you can do at 35,000 feet. Oh, I see him coming in our direction now. Hola, is there anything I can do for you? Excuse me. Hola, ¿hay algo que yo le puedo hacer para usted?
The man takes out what appears to be a razor-like instrument and grabs flight attendant Cecile. With one arm around her midsection, he puts the instrument against her neck and the other, all the while pulling her toward the cockpit door. She struggles with the man as they near the cockpit door. The first officer opens the door on his way to the forward lavatory.
Hey, what's this? What's going on here?
The man pushes the first officer back into the cockpit and shows the inside of his jacket with what appears to be an explosive device. In broken English, he tells the first officer to take his seat and at the same time advises the captain that he wants him to land the airplane in Cuba.
Well, we only took enough fuel back in New York to take us to Miami, and I'm not sure we can make it safely to Havana.
The captain lowers his right hand to the aircraft transponder to dial in the emergency in-flight hijack in process code.
The alert air traffic control to alert air traffic control that an aircraft is being hijacked, a pilot under duress should squawk 7500 or vocally by radio communication transmit aircraft call sign. Transponder 7500. This should be done when possible and safe. An air traffic controller who suspects an aircraft may have been hijacked may ask the pilot to confirm squawking assigned code. If the aircraft is not being hijacked, the pilot should not squawk 7500 and should inform the controller accordingly. A pilot under duress may also elect to respond that the aircraft is not being hijacked, but when neglect to change to a different squawk code. It is, in this case, the controller would make no further requests and immediately inform the appropriate authorities. A complete lack of response would also be taken to indicate a possible hijacking. Of course, a loss of radio communications may also be the cause for a lack of response, in which case a pilot would usually squawk 7600 anyway. It should be noted that on 9/11, the suicide hijackers did not make any attempt to contact ground control to inform anyone about their hijackings, nor engage in any dialogue or negotiations. However, this hijacker pilot of Flight 11 and the ringleader of the tourist cell, Mohammed Ara, mistakenly transmitted announcements into air traffic control, meaning to go through the Boeing 767. Also on board, flight attendants Amy Sweeney and Betty Ong called the American Airlines office, telling the workers that Flight 11 was hijacked. 9/11 hijacker pilots Ziad Jarrar and Hanoi Anjur aboard Flight 77 and 93 also made similar error when they mistakenly transmitted announcements to ATC about the hijacking. Cecile.
Thank you. As our special guest tonight, we have Ron Long, formerly with Eastern Airlines. Ron and I worked together in the hijack deterrent program. And Ron, after leaving Eastern Airlines, he went to DHL, and he was, let Ron tell you his position there in security also. Ron, could you tell us tonight when you receive a call? I'm not reading very good here. Our show tonight, and before telling us what you and your team would do, when you receive a call from a crew member or air traffic control advising you of the situation of an Eastern Airlines Flight 252, tell us about your job while you are with Eastern.
Thank you very much, Cecile. When in 1969, Eastern was experiencing a lot of hijacking, and as a result, Mike Pinello, Captain Mike Pinello, hired former Marine Lieutenant Colonel Jack Shields to come to work. And Jack had been the major safety officer in the Marine Corps at that time. When he came to Eastern, his primary focus was to stop the hijackings. So as a result, that was his major duty. He worked alone up until, I guess, his first employee was Cecile in 1972. However, at that time in 1969, I was assigned to Jack with several other people. I had worked in sales and service staff to see what we could do to stop these hijackings. And there was, in order to stop them, we had to look how they were happening, where they were happening, and the people that were involved. As a result, and working with the FAA at this time, Eastern took the leadership role and developed a profile for all hijackers at that time. The profile was anyone who purchased a ticket, one-way ticket for cash, and had trouble speaking English, they were automatically designated a profilee. At that time, when they went to the gate, they were subjected to further searches. Now, at that time, we didn't have 100% screening, but we had a U.S. Marshals Service that assisted us in this, and we had our own people that assisted us. And every time there was an individual that met that profile, we did this, that was logged, recorded, it was sent down to Miami, and one of Cecile's main jobs at that time was collating all this information, determining where it was happening, who it was happening to, et cetera, et cetera. So at that time, our job, as I said, was to try to stop this. We instituted a training program. We invited, it wasn't invited, it was mandatory, actually. We had one representative from every Eastern station come in once every 3 months for anti-hijack training. They would come to Miami, and we would go over all the latest information and what we needed for them to do. So this is basically what our job was at that time. And the next step was when we received hijack notification, what did we do? In essence, there were three people. There was Jack, myself, and Cecile that worked in this area. When we received this notice, we would immediately contact the originating station and try to find out as much about those passengers that boarded. Did we have any profilees? Were they searched, et cetera, et cetera? Any information we could glean. The next thing we did, and during this whole process now, the captain of the flight is in contact with system control. He's also in contact with the ATC at this time en route to Havana. Well, our next step was determining to how are we going to get this aircraft back, make sure it landed safely. We had an intersection in Cuba that we dealt with, basically from the Swiss embassy. This intersection would be the ones that would go in and negotiate for us to how much we were going to have to pay to have that aircraft returned. Sometimes the Cuban authorities would turn the aircraft right around, let it return. Sometimes they kept it on the ground. One of the jokes was they always opened up the bar and the restaurant and everything so that the passengers could eat, drink as much as they wanted, and in turn we would get the bill for it. So it was quite an expensive proposition, keeping an aircraft out of service that long, and also paying the fees for the returns and making sure everything was handled properly. In several cases, we had to send a corporate jet or one of our regular jets at that time. We had a corporate jet up until Frank Borman came, and he said we didn't need a corporate jet anymore. We had an airline, which made a lot of sense. But we would have to send that down and work with the Swiss intersection at that time to negotiate the release of the aircraft. What our staff did, too, at that time was we looked at this program to see what worked and what didn't work. In almost every case, the individual who hijacked that aircraft met the profile. What a lot of people don't realize is while Eastern had a lot of hijackings during this period of time, we stopped a lot of them. Approximately 32 hijacks were stopped as a result of this profile system. When Eastern's hijacking started to deteriorate in late 1971, or actually at the end of 70, they started to slow down a lot. The other airlines started to see these hijackings, and we actually flipped the problem from us, for the most part, to the other carriers. During this process, too, one of the things that we did, we had to purchase magnetometers, as they call them at that time. Today, they're weapons detectors. And the difference in a magnetometer weapons detector, one is a passive unit, the other is an active unit. So we had all these in place at probably by the end of 71, going into 72. Well, at the end of 72, the FAA decided that we were going to go to 100% search. They gave us this notice on December 5th, 1972. We had 30 days to set up all the security checkpoints in our system, to contract guard personnel to man these checkpoints, and to train all these individuals. It was absolutely a massive undertaking. I know myself and Jack, we were on the road 30 straight days during that time trying to get all this stuff done. And then on January 5th, 1973, we started the program at that time, the 100% program. But it hadn't ended then. While hijacking started to slow down, we still had to put together a standard security program. And again, Eastern led the way. I have to say this. There's no one individual that did more to stop hijackings than Jack Shields. And I'm not biased. I just worked with him, and I know how much he put into this. But we put together a standard security program, and our program was used as the model for all the other carriers. And the FAA adopted our model. For the most part, probably 90% of it was Eastern's program. And they put this into play, and this is what existed. Even today, all the airlines operate under parts of this program. So, but just one other little note. When Jack was by himself and the way I got hired into this job, I used to go and fill in for Jack. My boss would release me from sales and service to fill in for Jack. And he... one day I get a call from Captain Pinello. It says, Jack's in Tokyo. We had a hijacking. I need for you to return to Miami at this time. And I said, I can't. I said, I'm up here working for my boss. He said, well, you want to go to work for Jack? I said, yes, sir. He says, well, you're hired. And that's how I got hired into the job. It's crazy how things happen. But I think I've covered the points that we had talked about before.
If I could add to that, Ron,
yes.
When Ron installed the magnetometers, I remember there was just the three of us. We were quite a team. And Ron worked ferociously, I think 12, 14-hour days for those 30 days that you had him install the magnetometer. So he would go to every station and install them. And then, of course, it would be hiccups, so the station managers would call, and Ron would call them back and correct whatever. But 90% of the time, 99% of the time, they were always perfect. And I want to remind everybody, had the profile been used on 9/11, three-quarters of the hijackers wouldn't have gotten on the plane because they fit the profile. So Jack Shields, who since has left us in 91, was it, Ron?
Yes, 91.
He's watching over us up above, but I worked with him for 5 years, and he was a heck of a man, brilliant brain to work for. And he's mentioned in a couple of books. I don't recall the name of the books, but he was quite a Marine. And Captain Pinello, who's no longer with us either, is Captain Michael Pinello. He was awesome to work for. And he was a Capricorn, by the way. I remember that his birthday was in January, which I am also. And I remember when I was doing reports for Jack and Ron, I was typing on a manual typewriter. That's dating us. But anyway, Captain Pinello says, Cecile, Captain Pinello always would stop by and say hello in system control room, of which, by the way, there's usually like 100 men in there, and I was the only female. Remember that, Ron? in the system control room. And that's where, anyway, Captain Pinello came by, and he said, Cecile, I said, Captain Pinello, I need an electric typewriter. And he goes, well, Cecile, you know, in life, if you don't ask, you don't get. And the very next day, I got an electric typewriter. So I always remember his kind gesture, and he was such a great person to work for. One other thing, before Ron joined us, Ron, I think maybe you might have been out of town. I don't remember which hijacking it was, but I get a call from FAA and they say, this is flight such and such, your plane such and such just got hijacked to Cuba. Now I'm in there by myself with system control. Jack's out of town. I don't know if Ron had joined us by then, but I had to run to Captain Pinello's office and tell him, Captain Pinello, by the way, I was only 2 weeks on the job. I had just been hired with Eastern. And I said, Captain Pinello, flight such and such is hijacked to Cuba. Well, within 5 minutes, everybody, including Colonel Borman and all the people involved, met into system control, and then they get the captain on board on the plane. And then Ron can take it from there what happens there. They all merge into system control room and discuss with the captain. And I guess, Neil, did you ever have a hijacking?
Yes, we set up for every flight we set up a command center in system control, but also when every flight returned to Miami, and when it returned to Miami, we had to meet with the FBI and FAA, and all the crew and many of the passengers were interviewed at that time. And again, too, the importance of it is all the information was gleaned and put together. And it was put together in an effort to stop, you know, future hijackings. So it was a major part of our program was to assist the FBI and the other agencies in finding this out.
Ray and Cecile, I wonder if you remember the flight 30 that Frank. Frank, are you with us?
I'm here. Okay.
Flight 30, I believe it was, in 1971, did you say, was up in LaGuardia?
May 28th, 1971. And
can you give us a little background detail about that?
It was a 727-200, and it was due into LaGuardia at about 9:35 at night. We had no word that it was being hijacked, but the first that I knew about it was a Port Authority policeman came into the main terminal building and got my ear and said, Frank, come with me. Where? He said, one of your planes is being hijacked. We're going over to the Marine Terminal. So I went along with him and got over to the Marine Terminal, and all the passengers were coming off the airplane at that time, followed by the flight attendants. And I spoke to the senior flight attendant, and I said, what's going on the airplane? Because we still didn't have any communication from my part as to what was going on. The flight attendant said, there's a guy in the cockpit who says he's got a bomb. And subsequent to that, somebody from the Port Authority came up to me and said, they want to shoot the tires out on the airplane. So I was in a position where I could look into the cockpit, and the hijacker was out of sight behind the crew, and I used my fingers to simulate using a gun, and the captain's eyes almost popped out of his head, and he shook his head no. Subsequent to that, I went on the airplane, and I stood in the back of the plane talking to the captain, and he said, this guy wants to see his wife. So I got word to the Port Authority police, and they sent the car out to Long Island to get the get his wife. Subsequent to that, the wife shows up, and in the meantime, the captain said he wants a certain amount of fuel on board the airplane. So we put the fuel on, and then his wife showed up. And as I said, your wife is here. Now, I'm talking from the rear flight attendant station at the back of the airplane. And I said, your wife is here. And he said, I won't use the language that he used, but it was pretty profane, saying, I don't want that blankety blank here. She's my problem. Get rid of her. So I had all of these things again. I never had any experience with this kind of thing. And so the cop was coming up the steps with the wife, and I'm pushing the rear door shut. Don't let him up here. He's threatening to blow the plane up. Well, this went on for quite a while, the back and forth, the talk. The FBI showed up at the airplane. Captain Walt Brady from flight operations showed up, and I asked him if he wanted to go in and talk on the plane and talk to the crew. No, he didn't want to go on the plane either. you know, this is what was going on for quite a while. And this all probably lasted well over an hour. And the captain said to me, I want to start the engines, and which I went out the back of the plane, and we gave the signals to start the engines, and away he went. Now, I didn't know where he was going at the time. Subsequent to that, I found out that he was heading to the Bahamas. And I know that Jack Shields and the chief pilot, O'Neill.
Johnny O'Neill,
Yeah,
O'Neill took off on the Aero Commander, and they flew over to Nassau, and Jack was carrying an attaché case, supposedly with the money that this guy was asking for in Nassau. And as I understand it, as they walked across the ramp, they attacked the hijacker, and they knocked him to the ground. And I think he was pretty sorry at that point he ever tried to hijack an airplane, because he was dealing with a couple of tough hombres from Eastern Airlines. And that's about it.
Well, you said something that was key, that you didn't know a lot what was happening, and we all learned from different things as it went on. It was a real learning experience in this. And we learned from one hijacking to the other. And I would like to mention one other hijacking that you're going to talk about later. It's the May 5th hijacking from Allentown to Washington. It went Allentown, Washington, New Orleans, down to Honduras. And this was our D.B. Cooper hijacking. In Washington, they took off all the passengers. He wanted $303,000. At that time, it was hard to get $303,000 together in a short period of time. But we got a bank. We got it. Higginbottom then, I think it was at the time, that he got the money. And they gave it to him then. They went to New Orleans. They refueled in New Orleans. Then they went to Honduras, where he parachuted out of the aircraft. And that was a 727, where they, at that time, you could drop the rear stairs. As a result of this hijacking, and also the Cooper hijacking, this is where they put a fix on it so you couldn't dump the rear stairs in flight anymore. So he jumped out, and it was Jack and Captain Pinello the next day. So we printed up probably 25,000 flyers offering a $25,000 reward. We sent one of our 727s down again. And we opened up the rear of the air stairs, and they dumped out all these flyers in the area where Holloman had jumped out. So, of course, $25,000, anybody would kill anybody for that down in that area. And he turned himself in. He was a hunting man. He turned himself into the embassy. And, again, we sent another aircraft down there, picked him up with the U.S. Marshals, took him to Jacksonville, where he was arraigned. He was tried, and he had 20 years in jail. For the hijacking is what he received. Now, they asked him why he hijacked the airplane and why he needed money. Now, this wasn't a Cuban. This was just somebody looking to make money. He was an oil worker who had been diagnosed with cancer, was given a short term to live, and he wanted the money for his family. Well, as it turned out, it was a false diagnosis, and he lived the whole time when he was in jail. And on that note, I'll turn it back to Neil.
Wait, I have a question. Neil, I have a question.
Sure.
Because he turned himself in, did he get the $25,000 reward?
Oh, no. He was waiting at the fence, the embassy, waiting for him to open, hoping nobody would kill him.
That's funny. Yeah. Ron, what was the name of the hijacking where the guy parachuted?
Oh, that's D.B. Cooper. Well, D.B. Cooper and then ours was Heinemann. They both hijacked out.
Yeah.
Okay, Jack Shields had an opinion on what happened to the guy they never found. Do you recall what his opinion was on that?
Well, I don't recall.
I don't recall what. I know Jack and I used to talk about it, but I'm having a senior moment. I don't remember
did,
what
we did. We did a wonderful show on D.B. Cooper. As a matter of fact, we had D.B. Cooper as one of our cast as one of our hosts, I think, playing D.B. Cooper. But to move this right along, I want to just mention the fact that the so-called golden age of skyjacking in the U.S. ran from 1968 through 1979. Now, I'm going to set you up, Ron, in just a minute, and into the 1970s in parts of the world, with attacks tapering off after as new regulations made boarding aircraft with weapons extremely difficult. Some of the notorious, as a matter of fact, the one we were just talking about happened in 1971. A man named, known only as D.B. Cooper, is credited with inspiring both copycat crimes, which there were two after his, and winning enduring infamy by hijacking an airplane and collecting $200,000 in ransom money and a parachute before jumping. He has never been identified. And some of the Eastern Airlines hijackings included the following, and I'll just real quickly run over them. July 24th, 1961, Eastern Airlines Flight 202, a Lockheed L-188 Electra is hijacked to Cuba. September 20th of that year, Eastern Airlines Flight 950, a Boeing 720, is hijacked to Cuba. March of 1970, Eastern Airlines Shuttle Flight 1320, carrying passengers from Newark to Boston, was hijacked around 7:30 p.m. by John J. DeVivo, who was armed with a 38 caliber revolver. And Captain Robert Wilbert Jr., 35, a former Air Force pilot who had only been promoted to captain 6 months prior, was shot in his arms by the suicidal hijacker. His co-pilot, First Officer James Hartley, 31, was shot without warning by DeVivo and collapsed. DeVivo then turned the gun on the captain, causing arm injury. Despite being fatally wounded, Hartley recovered sufficiently to rip the gun to DeVivo's hand and shot the would-be hijacker three times before lapsing into unconsciousness and eventually death. And although wounded and slumped between the seats, DeVivo rose and began clawing at Captain Wilbur, attempting to force a crash. Wilbur hit DeVivo over the head with a gun he had retrieved from the center console. With a .38 slug in his arms and bleeding profusely, he flew his aircraft safely to a landing while talking to the tower, telling them his co-pilot was shot, but not himself, and needed an ambulance. The pilot was able to land the plane safely at Logan International Airport, and the hijacker was arrested immediately. On November 1, 1970, DeVivo hung himself while awaiting trial at Charles Street Jail. On October 29th, a man, his two sons, and a third youth hijacked an Eastern Airlines jet from Houston to Havana. They kill a ticket agent during seizure of the plane. I knew that captain very well, Captain Lee Hines, who was the chairman of the safety committee of the Airline Pilots Association. Lee was a great guy. I used to fly with him a lot. Miami, July 10th, 1981, two men hijacked a jet airliner carrying 188 passengers with 12 crew members from Chicago to Miami and forced the pilot to fly them to Cuba. Official said, when the plane landed in Havana, the two men were arrested and six other passengers got off voluntarily. It was the first hijacking of a United States jet plane to Cuba since last September 17th. There were no injuries in the incident, official said. William Nettles, assistant special agent in charge of the Miami office of the FBI, said that the suspected hijackers were apparently Cuban and added that the other six persons were apparently relatives. The jet was an Eastern Airlines L-1011. It landed safely at Havana's Jose Marti Airport at 1:08 p.m. New York time, and the two men were arrested by Cuban security forces, according to Jack Barker, a spokesman for the FAA in Atlanta. and the passengers were allowed to shop. The six other persons, two women and four girls, voluntarily left the jet at the same time, Mr. Barker said. Other passengers were allowed to shop in souvenir stores before the refueled jet took off from Miami International Airport, where it arrived at 6 p.m. An Eastern Airlines spokesman, Jim Ashlock, speculated that the two men who hijacked the plane were disaffected refugees who came to this country in 1980, refugee exodus from Mariel Harbor in Cuba. I think that's the one that you might have touched on, Ray. And there were others, L-1011 from Artie Smith was on board, and my real good friend, Captain Bob Green, was hijacked. Tom Mayberry, another good friend of mine, was hijacked. All of these were Atlanta-based captains, and I knew very well, flown with all of them. And we had our share, but, you know, researching part of this program tonight, I found out that National Airlines had quite a few hijackings as well. You want to say anything about that, Ray? Well, let me turn microphones on here. I must have dropped off here. Excuse me, Ray, and all the microphones are on. But
you're there.
Do you recall any of that, Ray? I'm sorry.
You mean Ron, Neil, instead of Ray?
Yeah. Right.
Excuse me, Ron. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Ron.
Oh, yes. I was waiting for Ray to speak. There is something in the Chicago hijacking that was rather unique. A total of eight people were on there that got off in Havana. They had a total of almost 24 bags that they checked. The 24 bags was all stolen merchandise that they had purchased with stolen credit cards up in the Chicago area. Their plans were to take all these things down to Cuba and sell them. But what happened is the Cuban authorities, they didn't, even though the hijackers were asking them to open up the belly and get the bags, they didn't. So when they returned, when the flight returned, we took all 24 bags, and we had an auction at Eastern, and we gave all the proceeds to charity. So here they were taking it. It was just a unique thing that happened.
This is what
the
National Airlines, National and Pan Am had a few. Delta had some. Delta had one that actually went to Baradero, where the authorities there wanted cash for fuel. They wouldn't take the captain's credit card. And they had to take up a collection from all the passengers to get back. So that was another unique situation that came up.
Yeah.
But as I said, and when Eastern started to gear up our program, it started sending hijackers to other airlines. And the reason that we were number one, of course, is because our base was in Miami. And that's where, you know, they would take these Miami flights and just say, we're going to extend it into Havana.
Yeah. Well, Ray, when I said I'm going to set you up, here's what I meant by that. Hijackings, it seems, they were a thing of the past. Now we have terrorists.
Okay, I know what you're saying.
Aircraft.
All of you have seen the incident in Somalia where someone took a computer on board an aircraft, and it blew out the side of the aircraft, out of the seat. Well, actually, in 1985, we ran into a situation where inside sources were putting pressure-sensitive bombs in the seats of aircraft, and they would pick an inside seat next to the fuselage there, and they would put a Syntex that they were using. And they would put a timer on it, and it was a simple bomb. But what happened, it was set up in such a way that if you sat on it, it was designed to go off in 2 hours and 30 minutes. You had to sit on it the 2 hours and 30 minutes. If you got on it one spot and sat on it for an hour, then the next flight you sat on it for an hour and 30 minutes, it would blow. And TWA had it happen to them going into Athens. And the passenger was blown out of the aircraft, the same type of hole that you've seen on the Somali aircraft on TV. And then Pan Am had it coming across the Pacific, same thing. And we actually found one of our aircraft down in Latin America that was put on board the aircraft. When we started looking for these things after these others had gone off, and it became a mandatory search of any aircraft from outside the United States entering into the United States, we had to check all the seats and under the seats for any type of explosives. So this was what they were looking for at the, during that time. And, of course, that was 1985. And, then, of course, in 88, you had the Lockerbie bombing of Pan Am. But Eastern never experienced any type of an explosive on an aircraft like that other than the one that was found in Latin America.
Felipe, mira.
Any questions from our guests, our listeners, our host?
Yeah, the captain on that flight 30, you may have known him, is Eugene Sullivan.
I didn't know
him. No, you don't know him. Neil?
No, I did not know him. Gene Sullivan.
And one other, the fellow that hijacked that airplane came back to the United States, and he was in a mental hospital, and he attempted a hijacking a second time, but he was apprehended before he was able to follow through. Ron, that would have come back to your time. You might.
Right. No. I remember that happened when he tried to do it again. When he came back, he was released, and then he did attempt to do it again. But I think it was another carrier that he tried to hijack. I don't remember the name of those.
Bennett. His name was
Bennett. Is that him?
Yeah. That was the guy who was a former NYPD police officer. Right?
Exactly. That's him.
Yeah. I remember that. Yeah.
And he was neighbors of ours.
Wow. Well, we had some other information. I think Gagnon was going to tell us about the codes that we use on aircraft, and perhaps we all won't get into that, Don, tonight.
Neil, if I could say
yeah.
One thing on that Houston ticket agent that got killed, they still have a plaque, I believe, at Houston Airport for the agent, don't they?
Well, they did while I was still flying, and I'm not certain whether it's still there or not, but Lee Hines was a captain on that airplane. And
the hijacker was named Teller.
Yeah, they had a picture of him, the agent, in operations. Some of you guys flying into Houston, Steve, you still remember that. And George,
yes.
Probably do too.
Yes, I remember. I have a question for Ron. You mentioned the finding one explosive device in Central America or Latin America. Were you at the airline in 1985 still?
Yes, I stayed with Eastern until a year after we closed.
Okay. I was just curious about Flight 980, why there was never any formal investigation, because one of the potential reasons for that crash was sabotage, and yet none of the wreckage was ever returned to be tested for explosive residue.
And, you know, we asked that same question. It's with all the crashes that we, with the crashes that we had at Kennedy and into 401, all these crashes were investigated thoroughly, and this never was. That's the one that went into the mountain in La Paz.
Right, outside of La Paz. That's correct.
I know when it happened, we went down to La Paz at that time, but we stayed at the airport because there was just no way to get up there at that time, and we worked with the Bolivian authorities who it seemed like trying to work with the our State Department and work with them, it just seemed like we could never get anything done.
Yeah.
Well, Ray, I'm going to step in right now and introduce you to Ray. I mean, Ron, I want to introduce you to Ray Valdez. Maybe I've been using Ray's name for you, Ron, because I saw his area code pop up. And Ray, we're so happy to
I'm
have
here.
You tonight. I'm so happy to have you with us tonight.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be with all of you.
Well, we were talking about hijacking, and the last question was, I think, Ron, you were talking about the investigation of that Flight 980. into Mount Illimani. And can you tell us your perspective as far as what you did, your thoughts about that, Ray?
Well, there's a lot of mystery surrounded in it. As you know, when after the flight went down, Bob Shipner was the vice president and system chief pilot. But for some reason, which Bob Shipner didn't know, and didn't know until he died, Frank Borman sent, I'm trying to remember the name, I'm having a little trouble, Butchin.
Yeah, Butchin.
Butchin, to go down there, find out what happened, and sent him right away. He got in touch with a fellow named Gorachi, who went up there with no camera, no nothing to record anything with, and had to come down almost right away. So he didn't come back with any facts or anything whatsoever. The Eastern Airlines wanted to pay. The flight attendants were very good friends of mine because I've flown with them for a very long time. The pilots I did not know. But Eastern wanted to give each one of those families $5,000. And some of them had left six, seven, eight kids behind. And I thought that was a crime. So I got together with the mountain climbing club of La Paz president to see if he could run an expedition up there. And he asked me, yes, he said he would, if I could get some mountain climbing equipment, which I did up in New York and sent it down to him. And, of course, he went on it, and he took the movies and all of that. The two things that struck us most of the whole thing was there was no blood and no body parts, which was very strange because there were no animals up there, nor birds, nor any tracks of any sort. We found the charts in back of the pilot and co-pilot seat, and we even found some luggage intact. The fuselage was broken up, but pretty intact. Yet there was no blood. Now, you'd think the blood would stand out in the snow, and no body parts. That always
seemed
extremely...
Wasn't it about 4 months? Wasn't it about 4 months later when they went up, or four or five?
No, my expedition went up in March.
In March.
Which was, what, about 3 months?
3 months, okay.
But see, if there were no animals and no birds, no nothing, all that should have still been there. And there were no tracks or anything. And blood, you know, that never melts up there at 20,000 feet. So blood should have remained. And body parts, too. But it didn't. And I've always been wondering why that was.
Ray.
What was Ray's position there, Neil?
He was I think you were flying as a flight engineer on that very. You were supposed to have been on that very flight, were you not, Ray?
That's right. That flight was over New Year's, and I typed two off it because I wanted to spend it with my family, and so did the other crew members. So none of us flew that flight.
And to take your place was Second Officer Byrd?
Yes, that was his name, Neil, Mark Byrd.
Mark Byrd, that's correct.
And yeah, I didn't know any one of them, either the flight engineer or the first officer or the captain. But I did know all the flight
I knew the captain. This is George. I knew the captain, Larry Campbell. I had flown with him quite a bit in New York while he was here. And then he transferred to Miami after a divorce proceeding. And he did it specifically to fly to South America. But go ahead. It's not my intent to interrupt you.
My thoughts, George and Ray, is that, first of all, Ray, thank you so much for allowing me and sending me the video about the expedition that you funded and had to actually go up the mountain, take the pictures of the airplane, the remains of the airplane, And you did a beautiful job in the narration of that. And it's about 15 to 18 minutes long. And thank you so much. We have, I don't know whether George told you, but I finally put it on our website yesterday. And I did an email broadcast of all of our members. We are over 900 membership now. And in a day's time, we had 250 people to view that video. And I'm getting some fantastic email, Ray, as a result of that video. They're looking at it. They are inspired by it. They want to know more about why. And the emails are coming to me. And I've got a few of them here. I don't think I have enough time to read them. But it's been a fabulous, as Donald Trump would say, huge response to your video that you had made of your expedition up the mountain.
Thank you very much, Neil, for your kind words. I really appreciate it.
Well,
really appreciate
it. I have a couple of questions for Ray. Did the families ever get more compensation because of the accident?
Yes, well, here's what happened. Frank Borman called me to his office after he found out about the film. And we talked about it, and I said, well, you know, the film doesn't contain any finger pointing. As you can see, if you've seen the film, it doesn't put the blame on anybody. And I told him that what I wanted to do was raise funds for the families, because I thought $5,000 was just not sufficient. And he asked me, what would you do if they were well recompensed? And then I said, well, I wouldn't do anything. Well, about 4 days later, they called me up from South America and said they'd been offered $500,000 each. So obviously that was a really good amount, particularly for the people in South America. So I never really did anything with the film.
Wasn't there a petition going around to get investigation? Was that the petition, Neil?
No, that's,
yes.
I can add, that petition was put out by Stacy Greer, who's the daughter of Mark Byrd, who was the second officer on that trip. Stacy and her mother have been trying to get information from the National Transportation Safety Board since the accident took place. Obviously, Stacy was very young then. She's been recently attempting to get information. And so far, there's been nothing forthcoming. In fact, I know I spoke with Stacy not too long ago, and she had made a request under the Freedom of Information Act approximately 3 months ago, and she never got a response to her request.
Wow.
Wasn't there an expedition led by the ambassador's wife that was on that aircraft?
No. The ambassador's wife, Miriam Davis, she was on the airplane. She was killed. The NTSB ultimately did dispatch a team, but not until October of that year, over 10 months after the crash. And by that time, of course, you know, the seasons are reversed, and there was a tremendous amount of snow on top of the wreckage. Although they did find the tail section, and they dug throughout that area to try to find the flight data recorder and the voice recorder, but without success. And then some members of the expedition got a high altitude edema, so they cut it short.
Well, you know, go ahead, Ray.
Yeah, quick question. I think, didn't the NTSB try two expeditions up there?
No, there was only one.
Because I remember one. On one of my trips, all the members of an expedition were on board the flight.
Well,
you know, I would think at least they would have contacted the people that had the successful climb, the people I got, or contacted me. But they didn't even contact me to get pointers or any information about the climb. And I thought that was kind of strange. And I thought that expedition never got anywhere. They almost got one or two of the people killed. Am I mistaken?
No, that was correct, Ray, but that was the expedition in October.
Yeah.
There was only the one expedition, and that was the one in October where the Gerber brothers went. There were two representatives from Boeing, Al Arrington and Tim Baker, and then from Gregory Feith represented the NTSB, and Royce Fitch went as a member of the U.S. Embassy. And I believe that Bernardo Garaci, no, he did. I don't recall if he led that expedition or not. I don't think he did, come to think of it.
Yeah, I don't think he. I was surprised that they didn't contact me to get information on the whole thing. That was surprising. You know, I would have thought they would have, but they did not. I just happened to stumble on them. They were on my flight.
Well, Ray, I'm getting email, and one, I want to give you an attaboy from Norma Jean Borger, who emailed me that she had seen the video on our website, EALRadioshow.com, and her comment was, Ray's voice quality is perfect for this video. A wonderful job. Now, part of that email also complimented us. We are also grateful for everything you do. Love your kitchen radio show. Keep up the good work. So, two attaboys, one for you, Ray, and one for us.
So, that was very nice of her to do.
And I've got more. I mean, they're coming in as a result of that video. And I want to say and suggest to people that listen, we're listened to in probably about 50 countries around the world now. And I want to suggest that you go to our website and look at Ray's wonderful video. The quality is not all there. It's not HD or whatever you call this newfangled presentation of video. But by golly, the whole thing is well presented, Ray. And congratulations on doing that. You did a wonderful job.
Thank you very much. Well, one of the things that I told the mountain climbing expedition is that I wanted them to take a tripod. I said, I don't want an unsteady camera. And if you notice, the camera is very steady during all the shots.
Yeah.
And that's one reason why they could do it. They did finally take a tripod with them. And the original, I didn't want to do it in video because I was afraid the batteries with the cold weather wouldn't last.
Yeah.
So it was shot in Kodachrome. And then it was transferred digitally to video. But at that time, they didn't have the equipment they have today. And I've been thinking seriously because I have the original transfer on 3/4-inch videotape, having it done over again to make a better quality.
Well, I think that flight and the pictures that you have that are presented in George's book, Final Destination, they were very good quality pictures. And George, your printers did a good job of that. And
Those pictures, Neil, Alan Gerber took those pictures. He was one of the representatives from the Airline Pilots Association.
Oh, okay.
He had them all digitalized himself.
Okay.
And they were excellent. I agree.
Yeah, they were good pictures. Yeah. So if you don't believe that, a lot of people right now today think that, like I did before I met George Jen and learned about this, my mind was set to believe that that airplane was so far buried underneath a glacier of ice that it was impossible to break out and to dig into it and find any parts of that airplane. That's what I knew about it until George's book actually opened my eyes up to. And then with the video, it's quite clear that the photographers, Ray, that did your video, did a wonderful job of shooting the landing gear and other parts, even the side of the aircraft with the name Eastern on the side of the aircraft is boldly displayed in the video. So you did a great job. They did a great job photographing.
Thank you very much, Neil. And you can see that there must have been very little snowfall because you saw the luggage, you saw women's shoes laying right there.
Yeah, yeah.
If there had been any snow, all that would have been covered.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, I even recovered some pictures of that the that some of the people that were traveling on that flight had of the family. And I got a hold of their the representatives, and I tried to return the pictures to them, but they...
Yeah.
The pictures are very clear. They must have been traveling with pictures.
Well, you could read. I think you've got the... I forgot now, but you had a plaque. Wasn't there a plaque placed up there, Ray?
Yes. Well, I had a plaque made in silver leaf with a message. Mm-hmm.
Very good. And you could make that out in the video. So,
yes.
Folks listening, please go to our website, look at Ray's video, and I think you'll come away with a lot of questions that have not been answered. And hopefully, George Jen is going to be able to get enough people interested when they read his book and see Ray's video and put the two together
What's the name of George's book?
George?
What's the name of George's book?
It's Final Destination Disaster, What Really Happened to Eastern Airlines.
Okay.
Right.
And was that flight from Asuncion?
Yes, it was. It originated in Asuncion, Paraguay.
And the destination on that, I forget, was that going to be Miami or was that...
Yes, it was headed for Miami. Your first stop was La Paz. Never made it there.
It was La Paz, Lima, Guayaquil, Miami.
Okay.
George, this is Ed Slane. It's well written in your book, my friend.
Well, thank you, Ed. I appreciate that.
Thanks, Ed. Good to hear from you. Any other questions? It's been a good show tonight, hijacking and then bringing in Flight 980. And we're going to hear more this year about Flight 980, I'm sure. Wouldn't you agree, George?
I would hope so. You know, I think that Ron had probably a lot of questions about why there was never a proper investigation done of that crash also.
I did, and I knew the captain. I used to play tennis with him every now and then. He used to play in the Eastern Tennis Tournament. It's the same Larry Campbell. I'm almost positive.
Yeah.
But it is. We could never get answers then, and it was just like, you know, you ran into a stone wall when we went down there. Of course, the Bolivian authorities took over everything. And then, of course, I remember even when the FAA came down, they got nothing out of it almost.
Yeah, here's go ahead, George.
No, that's all right, Neil. Go right ahead.
Well, I want to read this one, too, since I've got Ray here and you too, George. Another email that was sent to me, and I thought it was apropos to this 980. And the writer says, I had a serious incident flying from Buenos Aires to Santiago on the DC-10 around 1989. I was a backseater with no maps, but after watching the captain accept a clearance to 16,000 feet and start descending, I realized we were still east of the Andes and the altitude was not safe. I questioned that, and after checking maps and safe altitudes, he leveled off at 18,000 feet. During the level off, the GPWS terrain warning went off, indicating we were dangerously close to the mountaintops. We lived and did not become another EAL 980.
Oh, yeah.
I think I have told Steve Thompson this story. It seems like the DC-10 was a lightning rod for excitement, and I was flying it out of Lima one night when the vice president of Peru on board, and Shining Path called in a bomb threat. Another time that Captain Dick DeWitt, a good friend of mine, became violently ill with 6 hours left to go to Miami. His orders were, no matter what happens, don't land this plane short of Miami. I was in the left seat for the landing. He was in the jump seat to witness the crash that I made. Naturally, the weather was bad, but we were able to land. He was off for 2 weeks and looked very gaunt and pale when he returned. Food poisoning was the problem. And that was from Donnie Griffin. Some of you may know Donnie Griffin.
Oh, yes, Donnie.
Lake City,
yes.
Florida. So we're getting mail like that, and I think it's inspired now by, Ray, your video on our website. Thank you.
You know, a lot of people forget that airport itself is 13,600 feet.
Yeah.
It's 1,000 feet higher than La Paz itself, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it's a fun airport to go in and out of, because I flew a trip from Asuncion to La Paz, and I, in 727, when we were flying the 200, the Super 200, whatever, but I can't remember the designation.
I think, and we only had three of them that could land up there.
That's correct. And I remember coming down downwind leg on the barber pole, and that was so much fun.
Was that daytime and clear weather?
Yes, it was. Yeah, and that was after I had just come across the mountain where 980 went into, looking for evidence and couldn't see a thing. Of course, it had multi-years of snowpack on it.
Oh, wow. You know,
Braniff had a procedure there at the airport where they never descended below 23,000 feet until they were actually over La Paz Airport. Eastern never employed either the Braniff pilots or that procedure. And if they had employed that procedure, we would probably not be having this discussion this evening.
Yeah.
Well, this is Ray back here again. We had a little thing happen there also. On one of the trips on takeoff, right after rotation, the co-pilot side window opened up.
Oh, boy.
Hadn't closed it properly. Let me tell you, the blast of air was incredible, and all the dirt flew from the cockpit floor, and flying the plane, and the captain took over, and he finally got the window closed.
Wow.
Because we were going well over 200 miles an hour.
Oh, yeah.
You know, just a couple of more kind of non-related emails, but I want to read them anyhow. Since they're talking about our last show, Flight 251.
Yep. Okay.
This one, it says, "Hi, Neil. Enjoyed Flight 251. You mentioned the Sabreliner. We indeed had one. In November 1966, Eastern purchased Remart Warner, who was a sales and maintenance distributor for the aircraft. This was because Pan Am jumped first to sell Learjets. Our liner was mostly used to get orders for aircraft. I don't know what became of this endeavor." Then another one was, in a recent email, you asked for pictures for your photo album. Attached is a picture of our reservations class held in Charlotte. And it goes on and talks about the names of those in the picture that was sent to me, and they are being posted in an album. Of anyone that has a graduating class with Eastern Airlines, the earliest ones we've got so far is 1955. Be happy to have it. Put it on the website. If you can include those names, that we'll put those there so people can identify themselves. When they were, some of them looked like they were teenagers. but at any rate, we're happy to get these emails from folks. And let's see, I've got one more. I have attached an Atlanta Reservations training class picture dated October 1968. So people are listening and looking in their albums and sending pictures of their employment, their first pictures of employment with Eastern Airlines. What a great airlines we all work for, folks. It was a class act, and nothing has rivaled it since Eastern Airlines. And hopefully the new Eastern Airlines will work very hard to come up with a product that the pioneers that we talk to now over our radio show have made of the old Eastern Airlines. I hate to say old Eastern Airlines, but we want to get more.
Let's call it OLE, Neil. Neil, if I could take a second and thank Ron Long for coming on board and speaking to us tonight about the hijack deterrent department that he and Jack Shields worked on with Captain Finello. Ron, thanks a million for coming on today. We really appreciate all your input.
Well, it's been a lot of fun, and I can't wait to read George's book and also to see the film. And it's been a great pleasure recently to watch the campaign and watch the Eastern aircraft in the air. I don't know who chartered it. I can't remember who, but I've seen it on TV quite a bit.
Yeah.
Multi candidates.
Okay.
I can't say anything about their choice, their judgment, but
the airplane chose
Eastern.
Isn't it the hockey team and all that?
Yeah.
Ron, if you go on Facebook and type in Eastern Airlines, there's about three Facebook pages, and you have all those things on there. Kind of neat.
Well, I can't tell you how many people said, I thought Eastern Airlines was out of business after seeing it on TV lately. So.
Yeah.
But not anymore. Yeah. And, Ron, you're welcome back anytime. We'd love to have you participate with our hosts. And you've got a lot to talk about your time with Eastern and all the experiences that you had with Eastern. And that's why we like to do our show every month. That's why
it's
we
the greatest
like
job
about.
I ever had in my life. I got to tell you.
All of us say the same thing, Ron.
I know. But all thank you very much.
Yeah.
Neil, keep up the great work, will you?
Yes.
Hey, I've got to talk to you, Ed Slane.
Yeah. When would you like to do that?
Well, are you available tomorrow?
Yeah.
I'll be in and out tomorrow. I've got a handyman coming.
Now I'll phone tag you until I get you, okay?
Yes.
Sorry, he's taking me to lobster lunch, aren't you, Ed? We had lobster lunch tomorrow.
Not tomorrow. No, not tomorrow.
Oh, shucks. See, you blew it, Neil.
Perhaps later in a week, Cecile.
What a great time we've had tonight, right, Jim Hart?
What? Yes.
Hey.
Well, here we are, folks. Great landing, Captain Neil. We had a great show tonight, folks. Mr. Producer, another outstanding show. You know, it's always fun when we talk about Eastern Airlines and the place we work. And now we can talk about the new Eastern Airlines. You know, we feel we've been truly earned the title of the radio voice of Eastern Airlines. And it's all because of you, our callers, our listeners, our guests, and our hosts. We hope to see you again next week. Here we are in our sixth year of production. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Good night, Eastern.
Bye, Eastern family.
Good night, Eastern.
We love you.